I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pakistani intelligence officials say another missile strike has killed four militants today. And the BBC is reporting that a senior al-Qaeda leader was killed in a drone attack over the weekend. The CIA has dramatically stepped up its drone attacks in Pakistan to more than 20 in September, the most ever during a single month. And this past weekend, in a series of rare attacks by NATO helicopters piloted by American military, more than 50 insurgents in Pakistan's lawless tribal areas were reportedly killed. Add to all this, General David Petraeus has warned of possible ground attacks in that area. And all of this comes as journalists are picking up on a quote, pardon me, from Major General John Custer, Director of Intelligence at U.S. Central Command, who in 2007 confronted higher-ups about having no good intelligence to fight three wars. Three wars? Well, that prompted MSNBC's Rachel Maddow to ask Special Envoy Richard Holbrook on her program last night whether the U.S. is in an undeclared third war with Pakistan. Here's part of that exchange.
War really is hell.
Is it war in Pakistan?
You've seen it. War in the western part of Pakistan. Thousands and thousands of Pakistanis have been killed by the Pakistani Taliban. Thousands. Those are the people who trained the Times Square bomber. Al-Qaeda is sitting up there. The Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani group are sitting up there, killing Americans, attacking the Indian embassy. These are really bad people.
Let's take a few minutes today to check in on Pakistan. The BBC's Adam Minot joins us from Islamabad. Adam, your thoughts first on Holbrook. He didn't say it's not a war.
He didn't, you're right. And he pointed out what is very well known here is that there is a military campaign going on against those three organizations, Al-Qaeda, of course, the Taliban, who are based either side of the border, both in Afghanistan and in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and a group called the Haqqani, who again operate across the border. Now, these militants are being targeted both by the Pakistan military and, of course, by the NATO, ISAF and US militaries based in both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. So, I mean, you know, when do you describe a conflict as a war? It's a hard one, but there is no doubt at all that the campaign against these groups has intensified. I mean, you mentioned a moment or two ago, Robin, the figures, 20-plus attacks this month. That's more, twice as many than in any previous month. And if the numbers often are not very helpful, but I think they are in this case. If we go back to when the first of these drone attacks took place, that's way back in June 2004, since then there have been 196 drone attacks, 141 since Barack Obama became president. So yes, things are intensifying. There's no question.
Well, Holbrook also said the drone attacks are far more precise than piloted airstrikes. He said that one of the biggest mistakes of the Bush administration was to treat Afghanistan and Pakistan as separate issues. But how are Pakistanis, the government or people, responding to the attacks?
Well, I think that there's a distinction here which needs to be made between the drone attacks, which have been very large in number, and other incursions. There was an incursion over the weekend by military helicopters piloted by US military, and this greatly upset the people here in Pakistan, and the attacks were condemned as an incursion onto sovereign territory by the Pakistan government. And let's face it, the US is not popular in Pakistan at the moment.
Adam, it's been reported these attacks might be to disrupt plans for a terrorist attack in Europe. Do we know why? Is that true? In other words, do we know why we've seen this increase?
Well, I think that's the background music to what the whole campaign, in a way. I mean, the intention and the reason that NATO forces are in Afghanistan is to prevent attacks taking place in Europe and, indeed, the United States and elsewhere around the world. So, yes, that is a rationale underlying the whole thing. Why there's been a dramatic intensification in the past month or so, frankly, we're not getting information out of the military as to why that's happening. But clearly, they feel it is both operationally and strategically necessary to step up the attacks. And I guess one can only read that as a measure of the growing strength of these militant groups sitting on either side of this border.
Well, this is all taking place as the president of Pakistan just lost his immunity in cases involving some corruption charges. And you've said that the last thing the U.S. wants to see is a change of leadership in Pakistan. And it also takes place as the Obama administration plans its review of Afghan strategy in December. What is the thinking of how these drone attacks might play out?
I mean, the point you make is very important because the Pakistan government here is obviously absolutely central to this. Attacks are being launched from Pakistan. Having an ally, a reliable ally here in Pakistan, is absolutely vital to the NATO and to the US operation. And at the moment, the Pakistan government is particularly fragile. As you say, President Zardari, who is accused of corruption and faces charges in Swiss courts, faces the possibility of losing his immunity. Now, the Prime Minister here, Prime Minister Gilani, has said there's no way that's going to happen. But pressure from opposition politicians in Pakistan is building on the government here, and it is destabilizing things. And you're right. I mean, I mentioned it, others have mentioned it. The last thing that NATO wants is an ally which is politically instable, because that simply makes the whole thing more difficult.
And what about the U.S.-Afghan strategy? It would seem that an increase in drones in Pakistan might be to offset a future drawdown in Afghanistan.
Again, I'm not inside the minds of the military thinking on this, but you're right, there has been this increase. There is obviously, it's obviously considered to be both effective in tactically and also effective strategically. There's going to be a drawdown in troops in Afghanistan, that's been made clear. Whether the drone attacks are filling a sort of vacuum, it's hard to tell, but that certainly does appear to be the way things are shaping up.
Adam Minot of the BBC in Islamabad, Pakistan. Adam, thank you as always.
Robin, thank you indeed.
In the run-up to the midterms, we've been looking at various races, and today let's focus on two gubernatorial contests. We'll check in on the tight race here in Massachusetts in a few minutes, but let's start in New York. Democrat David Paterson, the African-American legally blind governor who met his evil twin on Saturday Night Live this past weekend. Some hilarity ensued. Paterson is leaving office. Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, son of former Governor Mario Cuomo, was comfortably ahead in the polls, and then came the Republican primary, in which conservative Rick Lazio, the GOP favorite, was upset by Tea Party favorite Carl Paladino. And now even Republicans are watching in disbelief as Paladino is closing in on Cuomo. Why the disbelief? Well, for starters, Paladino, a 64-year-old real estate developer from Buffalo, has sent out racist and pornographic emails and has a daughter with a mistress, something he told his other children, but not his wife. Let's start in New York. Longtime political pundit Alan Chartok joins us from WAMC in Albany. Alan hosted a longtime radio show with Mario Cuomo. He's also author of the book Me and Mario Cuomo. But Alan, we hasten to say you've butted heads with the Cuomos, so that people know that. And Carl Paladino, you know him as well as you know the Cuomos. So tell us your take. Fill out the picture for people who haven't been following this race, some of the other things he's said and done, and your take on him.
Well, first of all, Robin, thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. And second of all, I have to tell you that this is a race that a lot of people are enjoying, even though it's deadly serious. People ask me all the time, can Paladino win? And the answer is, yes, he can. The first poll that came out among likely voters, and this is very tough for pollsters to do, figure out who the likely voters are, showed Andrew Cuomo only ahead by 6 points.
Yeah.
Of Paladino. The subsequent polls, which were just polls of registered voters, showed Cuomo more comfortably in the lead. But this is a wacko year. And speaking of wacko, the Daily News had a headline saying, Meet Crazy Carl.
Yeah.
So the more that Paladino is beat up by the regulars, the more he seems to relish the race and to move ahead as quickly as he can by putting down Cuomo. He has the political operative Roger Stone, who has been a dirty trickster for a long time, talking about, calling Cuomo names and saying he's not really a man.
He also has a campaign manager by the name of Michael Caputo, who's behind some of these pornographic and racist emails. One that we can talk about depicted Barack Obama as a pimp and Michelle Obama as a prostitute. And Caputo says he runs focus groups with Republican men. They like this stuff. He's also hired strippers to embarrass opponents. He's had scantily clad women hanging out in polling places to attract voters. But as you say, Paladino seems to just keep gaining momentum. And so that people understand, what are some of the other things that Paladino has said?
Well, for example, one thing he said that caused a lot of eyebrows to go up is he would use the unused prison space, of which there's a lot in New York, particularly upstate New York, to house welfare recipients. Now, you can imagine what that did around here. He's
he dead said he would teach them about hygiene by putting them
in the prisons. Well,
he's also said that he would slash the state's personal income tax by 10%, shrink state spending. He'd prevent the construction of that community center near Ground Zero by using eminent domain. These are popular positions.
They are 20% off Medicaid. You know, this is typical class warfare. We know that the poor don't vote in the same proportions as people in the middle class and the wealthy, and you always turn the middle class against the poor. This is absolute playbook stuff we've seen before.
Well, what about his personal story? It's quite something. Apparently, Palladino had a son who had a drug problem. The son was well aware of Palladino's child, illegitimate child born with another woman. All the children were. The mother wasn't. The son.
They didn't tell the wife for 10
years. The son promised to go into rehab if his father would tell the mother, Palladino's wife, about his illegitimate daughter. Palladino agreed, but then the son was tragically killed in a car accident, and Palladino only told his wife right before the wake, because he wanted to put the little girl's name in her brother's obituary. Phew. I mean, how is the electorate reacting to this story?
Well, it isn't what you'd think it would be. You know, in a normal year, when you didn't have all these angry people out there, you know, he might be dead toast or burnt toast. But I think in this year, when anything can happen, I mean, I want to take it back, Robin, to the fight against Lazio, when the pollsters all had it 50-50. And too close
Lazio,
to call.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Rick Lazio, the Republican establishment guy, was a very nice man, and he just got trounced in the primary. So the pollsters are scratching their heads, wondering exactly how this is going to work out.
Well, Andrew Cuomo, Attorney General, of course, comes from the political family, as we mentioned.
Yep.
It had been said it was his race to lose, and his supporters are saying, hey, wait a minute, you've waited too long to come at Palladino. He only mentioned his name yesterday.
That's such a great point, Robin, because there's the old Andrew and the new Andrew. The old Andrew was kill him, kill him, kill him, you know, we'll win at any cost. And his reputation in New York politics was as low as a hound's belly. Then he gets to be attorney general in Elliot Spitzer's wake, and he does all the things Spitzer was doing. He becomes very popular, and a guy who I couldn't find for years, all of a sudden he's on my shows, he's talking to me, and he's kidding around, and he's as relaxed as you could possibly be. And so now all he's being criticized for not being tough enough, the old Andrew. So if he gets tough, then everybody yells, ah, we've been waiting for this. It's the old Andrew.
Alan Chardik, a longtime political pundit in New York, where, you know, it's my home state. I can say it. It's never a dull moment in politics, and certainly not this year. Alan's been speaking to us from Albany. And, Alan, we'll check in with you again on this incredible race in New York. Thank you.
Great fun. Thanks a lot, Robin.
But what we're going to do right now is take a break and check in Massachusetts. A very tight race there. Not quite as exciting as New York, but what is? Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Today we're talking about some of the high-profile governor's races across the country. Overall, there are 37 states electing governors in November. Right now, Democrats hold 19 of those seats, Republicans 18, and that includes one in Utah where there's a special election. The website cqpolitics.com lists 12 of those races as toss-ups right now. That toss-up list includes Massachusetts. We're going to be talking about that state next, but also Michigan, Ohio, Colorado, and Nevada, among others. Right now, CQ Politics say Democrats could pick up the governorships of California and Hawaii, while Republicans could take over five governorships, Kansas, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Wyoming. But again, all those are guesses, rolls of the dice. So let's take a look at Massachusetts. Incumbent Democrat Deval Patrick, the state's first black governor, faces former health insurance CEO Charlie Baker, as well as state treasurer Democrat Tim Cahill, who's running as an independent. And Jill Stein of the Green Rainbow Party is not considered a factor, but she's also running. David Bernstein covers politics for the Boston Phoenix. David, suddenly, a tight race between Deval Patrick and Baker. But how would you characterize it? I mean, it's all over talk radio, but it really has it caught on with the electorate?
No, it doesn't seem to. And, you know, one of the ways you can tell on that is that Charlie Baker, the healthcare executive you mentioned, who is the Republican nominee, who's been running for over a year now, and is certainly one of the biggest names in Republican politics in the state, 50% of the electorate still has no opinion of him one way or another, with just a few weeks to go for the election. That sort of tells you how much people are not quite excited and enthused one way or another about the race.
Well, tell us a little more about him. He was in Republican Governor William Weld's administration, top budget officer there. His opponents are trying to tie him to the financial fiasco that we lovingly call the Big Dig project here. You know, what more? Tell us a little more. Tell us what would a voter need to know about him?
Well, that's it. The thing about Charlie Baker, and he's been sort of the superstar that they've been waiting for, you know, waiting for him to run for one thing or another for a long time here. And the big thing about him is he exudes competence. He was, like you said, he was the financial exec basically under the Weld administration here. Then he helped turn around the largest healthcare insurance provider in the state and has been running that. And he's just, you know, he's tall, he's solid, he's good looking, he's sort of a guy's guy, but he sort of exudes.
I can't believe this is what we're talking about.
But this is what it is. He's like Mitt Romney in this state, but without quite that smugness that, you know, that Mitt Romney had. There was a little bit of a downside. So he's really been sort of the dream candidate. And a lot of the reason is because he's not like some of these candidates who have popped up in other states where we see, you know, a Rand Paul or a Christine O'Donnell or whoever.
Or a Carl Paladino.
Or a Carl Paladino, right. who might give people pause who right. would otherwise want to vote against.
But he's not catching fire. And yet we wonder, yesterday we spoke of the 10th congressional district race in here, the different race where Republicans have conveyed young gun status on the Republican candidate Jeff Perry. He's facing a Plymouth County District Attorney Bill Keating and nipping at his heels. And some are saying that maybe excitement about that race could give Charlie Baker a boost.
It could, because that's probably the heaviest Republican or right-leaning district in the state, and there is a lot of excitement about it. And the candidate there, the Republican Jeff Perry, showed a tremendous turnout machine during the primary. So he is going to bring out a lot of votes one way or another, and that should help Charlie Baker. Baker has to make up some ground with women, particularly where he seems to be trailing, and in the western part of the state where he's trailing.
Well, Deval Patrick, again, the sitting governor, grew up in a Chicago housing project, got a shot at private high school, and took it and ran with it. He soared. He went to the top of the business world. But he has low popularity ratings now as governor. And yet, some people were saying going into this race that, as you say, Charlie Baker, it was his to take. And Deval Patrick has been – can you say then that Deval Patrick has been holding him off?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you look at – compared to other races around the country where you have an incumbent, particularly a Democrat, trying to run for reelection in a very bad economy, it's a very rough time to be trying to do that. Deval Patrick already had some popularity problems even before the economy got bad because of some missteps early in his tenure. And then, of course, since the economy hit, he's got very high negatives. And then you did have this terrific candidate, you know, running against him. I think it is a surprise that it's a neck-and-neck race, and really, frankly, Deval Patrick's been leading in almost all of the polls.
But how much is his friendship with Barack Obama a deficit?
It's funny that this state... it does have a negative effect in the sense that those who are against the incumbency and against what's happening are more motivated to turn out because of that. But Barack Obama is quite popular here in Massachusetts. He has a 55% approval rating, which you know, is much better than the rest of the country. And a lot of people actually, it's a selling point that Deval Patrick is close with the president and can bring back, you know, some bacon from Washington because of it.
And what about a third candidate? You know, it's interesting. We're hearing in a lot of races, even outside the governor's races, that there are these lurking third candidates, the write-in, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. We're hearing Mike Castle in Delaware might launch a write-in campaign against Christine O'Donnell. Here we have an actual candidate, Tim Cahill, who was a Democrat who's running as an independent. He's trailing, but where might his voters go if they do leave him?
You know, the theory from the beginning was that his voters would eventually peel off to the challenger, Baker, because you figure it's a referendum on Deval Patrick, the incumbent. So those who are against him are going to stay against him and just choose a different candidate. We saw this in New Jersey, the governor's election last November, where the independent candidate sort of lost a lot of his support right at the end as people peeled off to the viable anti-incumbent candidate. But that's not necessarily going to be the case here, first of all, because Tim Cahill was a Democrat for a long time, so he attracts some Democratic supporters. But also, Charlie Baker and the Republican Governors Association have been so diligent at beating up on Tim Cahill, trying to knock his popularity down, that Cahill supporters now are actually more anti-Baker than they are anti-Patrick.
They should have tried to woo him over.
Exactly.
That's David Bernstein. He covers politics for the Boston Phoenix, helping us take a look at the gubernatorial race here in Massachusetts. Before that, we took a look at New York. We'll continue to take a look at races across the country in the run-up to the midterms. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow in Here and Now, a look at the new Supreme Court docket. But back with the latest news in 1 minute, Here and Now. A Rhode Island man has been indicted on charges of pointing a laser at a landing passenger plane, temporarily blinding the pilot as he approached TF Green Airport in Rhode Island. The plane did land safely, but amazingly, this incident is just one of over 1,700 in the first 8 months of this year alone, almost twice as many as last year. Who would do this? Who would point one of those high-powered lasers, you know, they make a red or a green dot, at a pilot? Just a week ago, a pilot was lasered in Ohio, less than a mile from an airport. And in late August, two Coast Guard helicopters were forced to land in Los Angeles after being targeted by a laser pointer. U.S. Attorney Peter Nerona of Rhode Island is seeing red. He joins us from Providence. Peter, is it a crime to point lasers at airplanes?
Well, it absolutely is. It's an interference with an operating aircraft, and it's a federal crime. And it's one that we take very seriously.
And we understand the Congress is considering tougher penalties. But tell us a little more about this. What are these lasers? How do people use them?
Well, the appropriate use, as I understand it, is to teach astronomy to children and people who are interested in that kind of thing. It sort of lights up the night sky. That's the most appropriate and typical use for it, legitimately.
We understand they cost only about $20.
They're not expensive, and that's one of the problems. They're easily accessible.
How did you find Joseph Aquino, who's allegedly pointed this laser at the flight coming into TF Green?
Well, you know, it was good police work. I mean, what typically happens is that the pilot sees the light, radios the tower, and immediately a law enforcement bulletin goes out. And in this case, there just happened to be a patrolman in the area who spotted someone who said there was a laser down the beach. They went down the beach. They confronted Mr. Aquino, and allegedly he acknowledged ultimately having the laser.
Well, why? I mean, why are people doing this?
Well, you know, that's really the question, right? I mean, there are two reasons to do it. One is intentionally to endanger an aircraft, and I'm not speaking about this particular case here, just in general. And the other one is just doing something that's really stupid. And unfortunately, there are people out there who do really stupid things, and this seems to be one of them. And as you indicated, there's been a lot of them recently.
Well, you know, people have lasered blimps at Fenway Park during baseball games. That seems like someone who just needs to be educated as to, you know, how dangerous this can be. But is this also a form of terrorism? Have people been accused of doing that?
Well, not that I'm aware of in the United States. No one's been charged with intentionally trying to bring down an aircraft. But that certainly could be an unintended consequence, and that's why this particular charge is one of reckless endangerment. That could be somebody's aim. We haven't seen that yet, but it doesn't make it any less serious when you're talking about lives on an aircraft about to land.
Well, given that, you know, you can see somebody maybe out on a beach, as you said, using the lasers to do what they're used for, to point out stars and planets and things, and they could accidentally come across an airplane. So what do you think needs to be done?
Well, I think part of it is just getting the message out. A program like this helps. It's the reason we addressed the media down in Rhode Island last week. I mean, people just need to understand that there's a time and a place, mostly a place for use of these devices, and certainly not on the approach to an airport. That's not the place to use them.
Yeah, because if you're further away from airports, you're unlikely to reach the airplane.
Right. I mean, in this particular instance, the airplane was only 700 feet off the ground, so that's a lot different from doing it out in a field somewhere, you know, west of Boston somewhere and shining it straight up into the air.
Well, but also in raising awareness, which is what you're trying to do, you're also, you know, alerting people that if they see neighbors doing this, you know, people should
right.
be informed about it. Aren't you also alerting people who might have more nefarious intentions that it's possible to do this?
Well, you know, of course, that's always the issue in law enforcement, right? And it's something we've talked about, you know, over the last several months. And, you know, that's the yin and the yang. You know, what choice should you make? And ultimately, you know, we decided that the best thing to do, since the incidents were continuing, was to get the word out to the public so that it can help law enforcement identify these people when they're doing what they're doing.
Peter Nerona, Attorney General for Rhode Island. By the way, what is the punishment if, in fact, Mr. Aquino is found guilty?
It's a 20-year maximum penalty in federal court, as well as a $250,000 fine.
20 years?
That's the maximum penalty. Of course, you know, it's not clear exactly what a defendant in a case like this would get, but yes, the penalty is up to 20 years in prison.
Peter, thank you.
Pleased to be with you.
Well, quick program note. Many of you had questions after yesterday's program on psychosis and young people. Well, Dr. Corey Kather, our guest, graciously agreed to answer those questions. And to read her responses, just go to hereandnow.org, click on past shows for yesterday's show. We'll be back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. This Thursday, Massachusetts, where we are, will make it illegal to text while driving. And if you're a teenager, it'll also be illegal to just use a cell phone while driving. But even as Massachusetts joins 29 states with texting bans, a new study finds bans may not have the intended effect. Of four states with bans, one saw no change in crashes, and in three, the rate of car accidents actually went up. Now, the study was backed by the insurance industry. A spokesperson seemed almost embarrassed in telling the Boston Globe there could be several reasons for the increase in accidents, including the possibility that people are still texting. And the report will unlikely stop the crusade of our next guest. Jerry Sibley is a businessman from Foxborough, Massachusetts. In fact, he once owned a chain of cell phone stores. And on Mother's Day 2007, he was on the cell phone with his 18-year-old son, Jordan, when Jordan drove into a tree and was killed. Jerry Sibley has since become an advocate for cell phone and texting bans. He joins us in the studio, and we have to start with our deep sympathy. It's a parent's nightmare.
Oh, yes, Robin. It's something beyond belief that it's not supposed to happen to you. It always happens to other people, and you say, well, you know, it's horrible. It's so sad that it happened to somebody else, but it doesn't happen to me.
Well, and you know, I'm sure you'd thought about it. I mean, I who hasn't thought about being on the phone with somebody if something like this happens? And we understand you tried to call him over and over.
Yes, actually what happened is I was on the phone with him. We were not having a very important conversation. Literally, it was about him forgetting to drop off the Sunday paper when he went home.
And this, we should say, this is a kid you talked with all the time. You were very close.
Oh, well, he lived with me, and we were best buds.
Yeah.
We had an awful lot in common, photography and graphic arts, and neither of us were very involved in sports.
But here you sold cell phones at one time. Had you talked to him about cell phones and driving?
Not only had I talked to him, we found probably five or six hands-free devices. All over the house, but none in his car that day. What happened was we were talking to him. All of a sudden, the phone went dead. We tried and tried and tried to reach him back. And then, of course, that horrendous knock on the door with the police officer standing there asking for the owner of a black Hyundai. And I immediately ran downstairs. Is my son okay? And the police officer, Dave Fiscaldo, said to me, there's been a terrible accident, Mr. Sibley. You have to get to the hospital.
They think that he dropped the phone, that he tried to find it?
It appears that he dropped the phone. He always wore his seatbelt. I've never seen that young man drive without a seatbelt in the same way that my daughter always has a seatbelt. So we speculate, and again, no one was in the car with him. He dropped his cell phone. It was a clamshell type of phone, so it immediately cut off. That's what happened. He then unbuckled his seatbelt, reached over. Although the airbags went off, he was below the airbags, and they assumed that what killed him was the steering column. And he was only going 30 miles an hour, Robin.
Yeah, looking for the phone. So you become an activist almost immediately. You've been on Oprah. I'm guessing you were behind her strong reaction to having texting bans and cell phone bans.
Well, I don't know if I'm personally behind it, but certainly
I think so,
myself
yeah.
and other victims yeah. of these type of accidents. I wrote to her literally within 2 or 3 days of Jordan's death. I spent the evening on one of the commercial stations and radio stations in Boston the night before Jordan was buried, and talking about the need for bans. And Massachusetts had been trying to get something passed for well over 6 or 7 years, and it kept failing.
But now Massachusetts finally has the ban, thanks to people like you and groups like the Safe Roads Alliance here in Massachusetts. But what do you think of this study? Now, Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood blasted the study. He says all the reputable research shows tough laws and good enforcement will help put a stop to what he calls an epidemic of distracted driving. But the people behind the study also released a study in January on just cell phone bans, and they found this virtually the same thing there, that there's been no change in accident rates after bans on talking on a cell phone while driving.
Well, personally, Robin, I'm not terribly surprised. When I was in college, I had this great book in my statistics class called How to Lie with Statistics. And basically, you can pretty much make statistics and research studies say anything you want. I'm not suggesting that these studies are wrong.
Well, even the people behind the study, I just want to jump in to say, they feel that it's because people are still driving despite the bans.
I would 100% agree with you. And so, therefore, my focus has shifted. And what my focus is, it's all about education. If we have a 3-year-old child and you ask them, what happens if you catch on fire? They say, stop, drop, and roll. And if mommy should fall down on the floor and can't talk, what do? I dial 911. This is proven. Now, how do they react and why do they react? They react because they have been trained. So I think it's going to take us probably 8 or 10 years more before we have a group of young people that have grown up with understanding the dangers of distracted driving, either by cellular or through texting. And it's going to be as routine for them when they get in the car to not text as it is for today's young people and adults to get into the car and fasten their seatbelts.
Well, and we know how many years it took for people to put on seatbelts. Now, if someone doesn't wear a seatbelt, they're considered an idiot. But you got a tough road ahead of you. A new study shows that 45% of drivers, 18 to 24, admitted they talked on phones or texted, even with bans. And another study, teenagers in North Carolina were observed coming and going to school. They were all on the phones. North Carolina has a ban. What would you say to a child, given, what sounds like you're a remarkable child?
I talk to children all the time. I talk to teens. I talk to parents. I tell them my story, and I say, look at me. I died on May 13th, 2007, along with my child. Yes, I can still laugh. Yes, I can still have a good time. But I think it's like somebody losing arms or legs. Yes, there are prosthetics and things like that, but he was my better half. He was my pal. I would kiss him goodnight every night. And no matter where we were, he would give his dad a kiss. I adored my son. I adore my daughter. And my daughter is so distraught over the fact that she lost her best friend. They were as close as any two kids could be.
Jerry Sibley, a businessman from Foxborough, Massachusetts, and now one of the leading advocates behind a new texting ban here in Massachusetts. He's also on the board of directors of the Safe Roads Alliance. As he said, he was on the phone with his son when his son was killed. For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Jerry, best to you.
Thank you, Robin. It's been an honor.
If you think the Food Network shows like Iron Chef and Chopped are tough, think again. They've got nothing on The Moff. The Moff, or the Meilleur Ouvrier de France, goes to the country's best craftsmen, including its finest pastry chefs. And now, veteran documentary filmmakers Chris Hegedus and D.A. Pennybaker have gone where no film crew has gone before, into the Moff Pastry Chef competition. One of the 16 to go to the 2007 finals was French-born Jackie Pfeiffer, co-founder of the French Pastry School in Chicago.
For 4 years, I sacrificed pretty much everything. Not everything, but it is going to be my moment.
How grueling is it? Over 3 days, they have to make a wedding cake, lollipops, sugar sculptures, brioche, 40 recipes in all. Each must pass a taste test and be pretty enough to go into the Louvre. The film is called Kings of Pastry, and filmmakers Chris Hegedus. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
And D.A. Pennebaker. Hi to you, too.
Hi.
Join us in the studio. Boy, people may be familiar with your past work. You did The War Room on the Clinton campaign, and D.A., you did the Bob Dylan film Don't Look Back. I bet this look at pastry chefs rivaled those in intensity.
It's certainly juicier.
And tastier. But did it, Chris? I mean, it felt like my nerves were wrung out.
It's surprisingly tense for a film about cream puffs and pastries in some ways. But it's really not just cream puffs. There's, you know, 6-foot sugar sculptures and everything that's being carried around. But, I mean, at the heart of the film, it's actually a film about character in very much the same way as the film about Bob Dylan is or The War Room is. And as a matter of fact, what attracted us to the story was our character, Jackie Pfeiffer, was being coached by his best friend and partner at the French Pastry School which he founded in Chicago.
And his partner has already the collar. Right. The collar is the signature of the MOF. Chefs who reach this highest status wear this special collar on their outfits. It's blue and red stripes. And you have a scene where two who've become MOFs talk about the meilleur way. Let's listen.
The meilleur way at France is about showing every day what you believe the best that can be done, you know, in teaching or in producing a product. Every day you put back your title.
Because the color we are the only chef allowed to wear those colors.
If you wear those colors and you're not, you can go to jail.
Ha, 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 but is that a joke? You know, if you wear the collar and you're not one, that's true.
French, you know, ever since Let Them Eat Cake, they've been very serious about the baking. And if you're a flour supplier and your flour isn't up to snubs, I think you can be put in jail, too.
Well, it would seem that way, you know, the way they treat food and the food items. But let's go at the beginning. You focus mostly on Jackie Pfeiffer, who we heard from right at the outset. And we watch him. You know, all of these men, and all the finalists are men, are athletes. I mean, they are literally working out, you know, to do what they do. Here, Jackie Pfeiffer talks about his sugar sculpture. Now, this is a huge white sugar crystal egg out of which rises this sculpture that I thought was carved wood, but he'll explain it now what he has.
Sugar. Everything has to be edible.
Right.
This egg is made just of sugar crystals. I just need one, but I'm going to make 9 just in case I break 8.
I make 9 in case I break 8, and then he gets there, Chris, and decides what?
Well, he decided that this new process that he was inventing, making these, you know, they were pretty big. They were about a 2-foot eggs that he was making, didn't work, and he had to kind of revamp his idea at the last minute. But these sculptures were amazing. I had no idea. Jackie actually took glass blowing. I mean, the figure that he was putting in this egg was pretty much like a Brancusi sculpture.
At another point, he's outlining on a whiteboard the wedding cake he's going to build. Buckminster Fuller would have been proud. it was so complicated, layers of different things. And they arrive in France. D.A., take a shot at just describing the 3 days of this competition. What did it feel like to be in there?
The physics of it were almost overwhelming because they had to be so precise and know so much that they couldn't even refer to recipes. They had to have it all in their heads hour after hour. And you're filming. The thing is, you're not sure what you're filming because you don't know whether they're doing it well or not well. You're not even sure what they're doing, but you have to keep shooting it.
Yeah.
So at the end, we were as worn out as they were.
Well, and we meet some of the contestants, too, from France. One man, Regis, I think was his name, who had an entire kitchen built into his basement, much the way some men have woodworking shops.
Nice.
Others who come from families who have long done this. What is their attitude, Chris, towards this work?
The MOF is really kind of a lifelong ambition. And most of these chefs started at 15 and apprenticed to a baker and maybe went on to culinary school. And in order to achieve the type of perfection and excellence that they're going for in the career, they have to do it every day in their work.
And when you get that award, it's for life. It isn't just you won the prize last week or last year. You win it forever. So for them, that's a huge jump.
Which is why there are heart-stopping moments in your film. One is when one of these carefully constructed sculptures collapses. Oh, I mean, how did you feel at that moment?
You feel kind of, as a filmmaker, both ways. You feel just awful for the person because, you know, you like these people. They're wonderful and so talented. And at the same time, it's like, oh, well, here's our story.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I mean, I think what's interesting, and I'm not really going to say exactly what it was, but how everybody dealt with these disasters in the kitchen. And I think that's what really separates this film about food from the Food Channel shows.
Right. There was empathy as opposed to, you know, on some of those Food Channel shows, you think a knife in the wrong hand could mean, you know, the end of a contestant. This is it really is a brotherhood. They really feel for each other. Because the fact is, they can all win. It's not that just one can win or two. There's a chance they can all win.
Or no one.
Well,
it's like a fraternity.
Yeah.
They don't want the winner. They want the people who are the best suited to be allied with.
Yeah. Finally, at the end, the announcement is made. Who will actually get the collar? And this head judge, who's been kind of tough, you know, is in tears.
Yeah. He knows how hard everyone worked, and he himself competed 3 times. So that's 12 years of his life he spent trying to get the collar.
Yeah. And by the way, does it really change their lives? Does it really open doors? Do more people come?
Oh, yes, definitely. You have, you know, more clientele. The prestige goes up.
And you also, when you get them off, you become a teacher and a mentor to others.
Mm-hmm. People always say the work begins when you win the collar because, you know, from then on, you have to do the best possible, and everybody looks to you for that. But it's also a mentoring honor, and you try to pass on your skills.
Organized. Look, the sheet pan is like this. There's sugar everywhere. Your table is a mess, okay?
Well, and it's a skill in which 1 second, at one point, Jackie says, 1 second the wrong way, and a candy would have been ruined.
Yeah, the chocolate.
Yeah. Did you ever want to say, come on, it's just pastry. It's just candy.
Try butterscotch.
Yeah, but Hershey's, you know, candy bars. You know, I mean, what is it for them that makes it so important to do it this way as opposed to buying a Hershey bar?
Well, I think for Jackie, you know, he really believes in the idea of doing things the best you can and passing on the idea of eating the best ingredients in small amounts and challenging yourself.
Well, it's like the Voltaire thing of good is the enemy of the best.
Yeah.
They all believe that, actually. It's their cry as they go into battle, you know.
Yeah. The documentary filmmakers Chris Hegedus and D.A. Pennebaker, their new film is Kings of Pastry. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
You know, originally we were calling it The Collar. And people said, is it a religious film?
Well, it sort of is.
Well, it is.
It sort of is.
But I don't think The Collar was a good title. We were happy to get rid of it.